We're in one of the student rooms of Christ College. This particular room was Charles Darwin's room, which he moved into in 1828. He later wrote a letter to his son. His son came to Christ in 1858. Darwin wrote him a letter saying, "Ah, yes, well, you're above the room where my cousin was. But I was in first court, in the middle staircase, up the stairs, door on the right, and capital rooms they were."
And capital rooms. Yeah. Well, I'm surprised at the sheer size of this main room.
Well, yes, to be a student in Darwin's day, not like what it is now, they were very wealthy. This room cost £15 per year. And he had a servant, a college servant called a gyp, who brought him his breakfast and set the table and cleared his things and took care of his clothing, complete with nice furnishings and nice prints on the walls. He was a very well-to-do young man.
How similar is it now with its wonderful panelling and its colours to what it was like way back then?
Well, the room now hasn't yet been restored. We're restoring it for next year to open it to the public. So it doesn't look much like it did. Although the room, the fabric of the room is all still here. Right now you have this rather attractive bare oak panelling. But in Darwin's day that was deeply unfashionable. They didn't have this kind of bare panelling. It was all painted. And we've had professional paint analysis done, so we know that it was a sort of pale, chalky white with a slight bluish tint. And this matched some of the fabric that we found in the seat cushions, at the bay windows, and he would have had curtains of a matching pattern. He would have had a large wool carpet in the centre of the room. We're having one remade from a period design to put back in here. So it would have been a very comfortable, somewhat luxurious room by our standards.
Yes, well, tell me about the cushions. Over there, there are two bay windows, and they're looking out onto the quad. Wonderful, serene quad. You wouldn't imagine that a bank and Marks and Spencers are just there across the wall. But when you sat down on the cushions, how much was preserved of the original stuff that Darwin had all those years ago?
Well, up until 6 months ago, there were just some synthetic seat cushion covers there, which you could unzip on the back. And now that we're trying to restore things, these were actually properly looked into. And underneath the outer layer was another seat cushion from about the 1930s. And underneath that one was another one from about the 1880s. And underneath that was another one from the 1830s, which is right for Darwin's day. And we think that they were actually still in this room because part of the colours of the fabric of the seat cushions match the paint we found on the woodwork on the bay beside the cushions. So we think they've actually been here all these years.
How amazing. I can see over there by the side of the fireplace, great big fireplace, there's a little cupboard and you've chipped away the paint and you can actually see bits of blue there from the original.
Yes, as you see, nowadays we think of these old environments with their waxed oak panelling as that's what it looked like back then, but in fact it would have been colourful to an extent that it's hard to imagine for us. Darwin, of course, as a student, was not a Victorian. This is before Victorian times. This is Regency England, not Victorian England, so it's a major difference. Mm. So when we're restoring the room, we're trying to be sensitive to the fact that this was a Regency student room.
He'd been to Edinburgh already, hadn't he? He'd been there to do some geology and he'd come here to do theology, was that right?
Well, that is what is always said, is that Darwin studied theology at Cambridge, but it's not true. It's based on the fact that he didn't go through studying medicine at Edinburgh, and his family said, well, why don't you become a clergyman? That's another respectable profession for the younger son of a wealthy English gentleman. But in those days, there wasn't a degree in theology, or indeed in almost anything else. To become a clergyman, it was a prerequisite to first get a BA from an English university in order to then enter the Church of England. So he had to get a BA, which he did. Then he would have had to undertake a study in divinity, which he never did because the Voyage of the Beagle came along.
I see. So he was actually doing a general BA in what?
Well, it's just a Bachelor of Arts. He studied the classics, Euclid, and William Paley.
William Paley, now there's a name. Was he actually in this room as well, the blind watchmaker fellow?
Well, there is a rumour, a legend, that Paley was in the same room, but there's no evidence in the college itself that can prove that Paley was in this room. However, college legend used to say that Darwin was in this room, and we now know that was correct. So there might be something in it.
I see. Wouldn't that be an influence? Can we just go next door and have a look at the bedroom? Because through this doorway is a tiny place, which is now a sort of bathroom and a bit of a library. Is this where he washed his hands?
Yes, this much smaller area is where Darwin this was his private space. So in this little back corridor, there would have been a bed where Darwin would have slept. And he had a dog. The dog may have slept on the bed with him. But back here, he would have been his dressing room. It was his private room. And the gyp would have come in the morning at 6:30 to wake him up and would have brought some hot water for him to wash his face and perhaps to shave. And then at 7, he had to be dressed and he had to go across the court to chapel until 8. Then he would come back to his rooms and his gyp would serve him breakfast, which was bread and butter. That's all there was. You could have tea or coffee, but you had to provide the tea or coffee.
I see. I must say that a gyp is the college servant. They're called scouts in Oxford, gyps in Cambridge. Mm. And so he would have had a permanent one to himself.
Well, it wasn't just at Darwin's, no. It was all the rooms on this staircase share the same gyp, so he would have gone from one to the other. And then after breakfast, they would have had college tuition or instruction from the tutor for a couple of hours. And then they had free time until they had dinner at about 4 o'clock in the college hall. That was a required meal. But all they got there was a joint of meat and a glass of beer. That's all that you were presented with, unless you wanted to have something extra, like vegetables or bread. And in the college accounts, which have recently been rediscovered, which show Darwin's college bills, there's actually a column just for vegetables. And that's why, because it wasn't part of your commons allowance. So if you wanted vegetables, we now know how much Darwin spent on vegetables in every week of his time as a student.
So what's these rooms been for up to recent years?
Well, in 1909, when we did this, when we celebrated the centenary of Darwin's birth, the rooms were open to the public, and there's a historic photograph of how they dressed them up. But since then, it's been a fellow's room. So until about the 1950s, a fellow may have still lived here, slept in this room. Since then, it's just been used for teaching. So it still belongs to a fellow today, but it's only occasionally used for supervisions.
I see, so students come in and tuting is done. And
yes, they sit around the table and their essays are read and they're given personalised instruction in the unique Cambridge way, but they have the privilege of being in Charles Darwin's rooms.
Well, let's go back into the main room, because here between the windows and lovely creaky floorboards, by the way, are the same floorboards or have they been replaced?
That we don't know. We do know from a letter that Darwin came back one day and said, everything's in a mess, they've been taking up the floorboards in my room. But we don't know if it was these or some other boards.
Between the windows, are saying, is the profile of the man, looking, I suppose, middle-aged. It's not that sort of ancient profile that you have, as if he was never young. But there you've got signs of that small mouth and that big brow and somehow a very sweet face.
Yeah, this is a Wedgwood plaque, which was made by Thomas Woolner. Now, it didn't used to be known, it's still not known exactly what the date of this piece is. But if you look very closely underneath the frame, there's a tiny white label that says that it was set here by Professor G.H. Darwin in 1885. That's Darwin's son, George.
Right. And of course, Wedgwood, part of the family.
Indeed, that's why I'm sure they were pleased to make this, because he was the son of Susanna Wedgwood, the daughter of Josiah Wedgwood, the famous potter. Unfortunately, there's a mistake. There's a second piece of pottery underneath which says Charles Robert Darwin, 1829 to 31. Darwin was in this room from 28 to 31.
So they got the date slightly wrong.
Slightly wrong, never mind, but that's up there. And some of the decorations, by the way, look up towards the ceiling. The frieze is wonderfully elegant. Lots of twirls and red and green. It's rather nice, isn't it?
Yes. Now, until recently, it was not known that this panelling was all painted with a sort of dark brown paint, which was only removed in the 1930s. And that's when they discovered that the frieze at the top of the panelling was coloured underneath. But the panelling is 16th century oak panelling. The piece around the chimney, because it's asymmetrical, was built in place.
Isn't that interesting? How would you compare, for instance, Down House, where he lived in Kent, as a record vis-a-vis his time at Christ's, as a young man telling us different things? Obviously, the record in Down House is substantial because he was there for so long, never going abroad, funnily enough, having travelled around the world in the Beagle. He just never left the country after that. But how would you compare the two places?
Well, I'd say there's actually a remarkable consistency between the two, because this beautiful, spacious room is a gentleman's space. This is the space for the gentry, where he's served by a servant. And this is a completely unquestioned form of social difference. Darwin would have never blinked at the idea that there are people who are servants and there are people who are gentlemen. That's just the world he inhabited. That is as true here at Christ's Cottage as it was at his home in Down, with the usual Victorian servants' quarters, servants' payments, etc. So there's a whole social world happening at Down House with Darwin at the pinnacle, but he doesn't have to attend to it all because there's all these people busily doing their jobs around him. All of that enabling him to sit at the table or at his chair and to think and to read and to study and to write.
Now, you're spending all your time on the Darwin Project, and so far we've been through a number of different examples where the legend is rather different from the reality. How much are you seeing of the real story as being different from what people assume?
I see it happening with astonishing regularity. It's really amazing how often you hear a story about Darwin or you grow up with one, you read about one, but when you come to search for them in the original materials, the original documents, sometimes they're not there. That can be very disturbing, but it happens again and again.
Give me some of the most striking howlers, if you like.
Well, probably one of the most striking howlers is the story that Darwin took back his theory of evolution on his deathbed, or that he converted to Christianity on his death. He was an agnostic in his latter years. I mean, these completely untrue, but they circulate very widely to this day. Nothing seems able to eradicate them. Another one is that Darwin, what he was really trying to do was to oppose the Bible or religion. And that's just nonsense. Darwin was a passionate naturalist. He wanted to understand how natural things worked.
And Emma, of course, was a believer, and he didn't want to offend her.
Ah, well, that's another one. That's one we constantly hear. But actually, if you go back and try and find the evidence for that, there isn't any. We don't have any evidence that Darwin did anything differently because of Emma. He always published what he intended to publish. Now, we know from a few scattered letters that Emma was unhappy with a couple of his views, but there were views that he published. So as far as we can say, from the evidence, Darwin held nothing back. I think because Emma was religious and Darwin was an agnostic and many of his views flatly contradicted various traditional interpretations of the Bible, they probably didn't talk about some of these things because it was a bit uncomfortable. But her main priority was to support Darwin. She backed him up. Her loyalty was to Darwin. And yes, there were. So, you know, he had some radical ideas, but you know, this was all in the context of the comfortable country gentleman. With his radical ideas, but that was all right.
And what about the procrastination legend that he buried himself in barnacles and latterly with the earthworms? Of course, the earthworms came, I think, towards the end more, but doing this meticulous work so that he could avoid doing Origin of Species until prompted by this missile, this exocet that came from the other side of the earth, Alfred Wallace's letter, which I think turned up something like 150 years ago, last July.
Well, it was their joint paper was read this July. Yeah. So in fact, 150 years ago, right now, the theory of evolution by natural selection was first published in the form of their joint papers. But no, it's unfortunately another myth that about Darwin being afraid to publish or that he kept it a secret for all these years. These are fantastic stories, and they used to be my favourite bit of the Darwin story. That Darwin knew the truth for 20 years, but he didn't tell anyone. In fact, that's not true. If you go back and look at just at the biographies of Darwin since he died in 1882, no one ever believed or claimed that that happened, that his life was one of procrastination or delay or avoidance until about the 1950s. So all the people who actually knew Darwin, and Darwin himself, when they told the story of his life, when they told the story of how the Origin of Species came to be written, they told it in a completely different way, one that, if you go back and check the sources very carefully, is exactly spot on. He came up with his theory after the Beagle Voyage, but he was already deeply embedded in a publishing project that took him 10 years to publish all the things he found on the Beagle Voyage. There were 3 volumes on geology, 5 volumes on zoology. There was his great book, The Voyage of the Beagle, 2 editions of that, numerous very important scientific papers. And then at the end of that, he had one little bit of material to publish, which was a barnacle that he'd collected on the Beagle. And that barnacle expanded into this big barnacle project. He had always been a specialist in marine invertebrates, ever since his days as a student in Edinburgh. So it's not a surprise that Darwin should have specialised on that particular area. It had always been his area of expertise. That's why he didn't give those specimens to other experts to name, like the others. He kept them back for himself. And so he'd finished all the other books. He was just going to do a couple of barnacle papers, and then he would do the species theory. But alas, the project, as so often with people who do projects like that, it expanded and expanded, and he ended up doing all known living and extinct barnacle species in four volumes. So the whole thing, together with about 2 years he lost to ill health, was 8 years gone. But by the end of it, he was sick to death of barnacles. He couldn't stand them anymore, so because it dragged on. Because you see, the nature of the project was of an exhaustive list. He couldn't give up when he was sick of it, when he was three quarters of the way through, because he's not finished with the list. So he had to get all the way to the end. And the very day he finished, he opened up his notes on species and worked full time on it. So then he's been working on that for a few years. He's about halfway through a very big book, probably would have been a three-volume book on species. And then Alfred Russell Wallace's letter arrived to the post and changed everything.
Tell me, before I ask you how you're going to celebrate, what sort of picture do you get of the guy yourself now you're so enmeshed in all the material? It always struck me as such a nice man if you compare Newton, who is a bit of a nasty man. Does Darwin strike you as a lovely, lovely guy?
Yes, absolutely. Darwin strikes me as a very good-humoured, pleasant man with very keen, passionate interests in scientific questions. So if you knew Darwin, you would have known him to be someone who was very friendly, had a twinkle in his eye, always had a good joke, but was more interested on the bee on the windowsill than perhaps the political conversation over dinner.
And to celebrate, what's going to happen next year?
Well, that's impossible to list. The number of things that are happening next year for the bicentenary of Darwin are absolutely colossal. There are exhibitions in virtually every museum in every city in the world. It's absolutely astonishing.
This is one in Canberra in December.
Yeah, I know all people who work on Darwin, including me, are doing a whole series of lectures and talks, and there's so many exhibitions and books. I'm publishing three books next year, and everyone else who works on Darwin is publishing books next year. So I think it'll take us until the next Darwin Centenary to read all of them.
And the bronze here?
Wow, Christ has commissioned a new bronze of Charles Darwin, which is very exciting. It's going to depict Charles Darwin as a student, as he was at Christ College. He'll be seated on a bench, and you'll be able to come and sit next to Darwin and have your picture taken. But there is another bronze, which was made last time around in 1909. That was made in New York, and it's a copy of one that was made for the American Museum of Natural History. An American delegation came to Christ for the centenary celebrations here, and they brought this bust with them. And it was made to give to Cambridge. But when they got here, most of the exhibitions were happening here at Christ College. So they gave the bust to Christ College, where it sits in a portico to this day.
I was with John Van Wy, a fellow of Christ's College in Cambridge, and the bicentenary celebrations are already underway. As you'll have heard last Saturday at the Natural History Museum in Adelaide, when Rob Morrison stood to present this poem about Charles Darwin and how lucky we are that he wasn't an Australian and off on a sickie.
Financially, a student's life is tough. The cost of books and union fees and stuff means students, as they study to get through, must often take a part-time job or two. The same proved true for Darwin, so that he, forsaking study, took a job at sea, as Beagle's naturalist in the employ of Captain and creationist Fitzroy. Seasickness struck him almost straight away, and as they sailed it cursed him night and day, until he wondered whether he could bear the endless agony of Maldemere. Then for a while Australia played the host to Beagle as it sailed along our coast. And Darwin's journal makes us understand how pleased he was to get his feet on land. As any proper Englishman would do, he took some walks and hunted kangaroo. But though we named a city after him, he found Australian customs pretty grim. In January 1836, our budding populace and politics were bound to seem a little bit uncouth to Darwin, born and bred a British youth. But colonies like ours were far away from Britain, and historians today remark upon the freedom distance brings, which lets us cut our mother's apron strings. Thus British customs, though they might have been revered by those who served their British queen, were fading here, where men of common sense soon recognised the charm of indolence. Thus was the great Australian sickie born to Aussies who still contemplate with scorn, bewilderment, suspicion and dismay a man who chooses work instead of play. These days a sickie doesn't mean you're ill, condemned to bed, the doctor or a pill. You chuck a sickie for the Melbourne Cup, to watch the test, or when the surf is up. I don't imply all that was going down in 1836 in Sydney Town, but knowing how they lived, one can infer that goofing off had started to occur. Historians hypothesise that we can trace that to our convict ancestry, when felons in the chain gangs thought it good to chuck a sickie any way they could. It's hard to know just what Australians thought of Darwin, who was quite averse to sport. Disdaining games and gambling, he averred collecting beetles was what he preferred. And so he thought it sad that there should be such appetite for inactivity among Australians who he thought were crude as well as venal, indolent and rude. So back on Beagle, green around the gills and seasick, Darwin kept applying his skills. His thoughts were on his specimens and not saying bugger this and falling in his cot. We who inhabit the Antipodes are apt to scoff at Englishmen like these. A seasick Aussie naturally would know to chuck a sickie and retire below. But Fitzroy saw a stronger man emerge, for though afflicted by the dreadful scourge of sickness, Darwin never tried to shirk his obligation to perform his work. Such is the British way, to get a grip, to show the world a stiffened upper lip. 200 years ago, you'd never find a sickie chucked by Darwin and his kind. By now, he had accrued a massive store of specimens and artefacts galore, which would have been enough for some. Instead, ideas began to form in Darwin's head. 5 years went past till Beagle had returned and Darwin started work on what he'd learned, but even then, although he was ashore, his illness seemed no better than before. Historians have thought of many ways by which to diagnose his long malaise, and experts, citing symptoms, have defined rare maladies of body or of mind. Some think that in his travels Darwin might have been infected by a parasite, while others take a very different tack and swear he was a hypochondriac. Beset by such afflictions, Aussie men would have secured a doctor's note by then, have chucked a sickie, dropped their work, and each have packed his fishing gear and hit the beach. But Darwin, steeled with British discipline, would never have considered giving in. Ignoring illness time and time again, he studied corals, earthworms, plants, and men. And Darwin's illness lasted 20 years, not spent in bed, but thinking up ideas and arguments until at last he'd solved the way that plants and animals evolved. The moral's pretty clear. It's simply this. Next time you've been out late or on the piss, a brief reflection on these blokes should show a sickie may not be the way to go. So take an aspirin and don't complain. Just pull your finger out, forget the pain. Reflect on Darwin, think of Wallace too. Consider what the two of them would do. Should bouts of Monday-itis come your way or thoughts of working fill you with dismay, don't chuck a sickie and remain in bed. Reflect on what you might achieve instead. For, just like Darwin, you may find you could reject a sickie for the greater good. And you may then discover, as did he, your name revered for all eternity.
Rob Morrison from Adelaide with a poem we shall hear in full, longer than Paradise Lost or Regained, next year as we celebrate Charles Darwin, 200 years of age, in February. Next week, The Science Show contemplates the leap second and we show you how to blow up credit cards at a distance. Very important. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune, and thanks to Rodney Marks for dying. As for you, don't get sick, well, at least stay at work. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.